is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
Ukraine, the headlines from London. We cannot rely on U.S. to help Ukraine. This is the EU speaking, telling the G7, no more confidence in the Americans are coming. The cavalry is here. In addition, Germany, Russian spies, that's in quotes, arrested in Germany attempting to attack weapons deliveries to Ukraine. Alleged plot is latest in a string of espionage scandals linked to Moscow. Also, deaths of Russian soldiers surpass 50,000 in meat grinder war. That's London reporting. Also, frozen Russian assets will help fund Ukraine as G7 deal nears. And Romania's far-right party to use lie detector tests to prove candidates' loyalty. All these are NATO-related or G7-related or EU-related stories. And I welcome Anatole Levin, a veteran of all those organizations reporting, but now at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft in Washington, writing with his colleague George Beebe recently about what is to be done, what is the viable way forward. Anatole, a very good evening to you. I read those headlines to make certain we were up to date in the chaos over Ukraine. Your measure, just in general, of these last days, all eyes have suddenly switched from Gaza to Iran. Heretofore, they switched from Kyiv to Gaza. This very much looks like the media only can do one major apocalyptic story at a time. Has Ukraine been lost these last days? Good evening to you.
Well, I don't know that it's been lost. I mean, people in the security world, and of course European governments, are still well aware of it. As a British diplomat said to me recently, you know, we do know that the Russian government is praying for a war between America and Iran. I mean, very few things, there's nothing on the international scene could be better for Russia than if America and Iran went to war. It would be, of course, a massive distraction of America. It would further discredit the United States in the eyes of most of the world. And, of course, not unimportantly, it would send the price of oil through the roof, which would greatly benefit the funding of the Russian war effort. I suspect that the British Foreign Secretary, Cameron, tried to make these points to Netanyahu when he met him yesterday or the day before yesterday. And Netanyahu told him to go to hell. Israel will make its own decisions. Despite the fact, of course, that Britain, along with America, has just defended Israel from Iranian missile attack. So somehow the various wings of our geopolitical strategy, if you can call it a strategy, appear to have become quite unhinged from each other.
Yes, yes. That headline about we cannot rely on the U.S. to help Ukraine, EU telling the G7. EU is 27 nations. It's a trading bloc chiefly. However, it does have a foreign policy in the presence of Josep Borrell, and it speaks out now and again about the future. G7, of course, are the seven largest economies measured at one time. That would include Japan. And we're addressing Ukraine in specific, so we'll come back to Ukraine. But just one note here, your observation about Russia and the conflict potential in the Middle East. There was a report that they wanted us to have on Monday that the president of Iran, Ebrahim Rouhani, made a phone call to Vladimir Putin and spoke with Putin in Moscow. Dmitry Peskov, who speaks for the Kremlin, this Kremlin spokesperson, said pretty much along the lines of they were consulting about security matters and said that there was nothing particularly irregular about the phone call. What do you measure that phone call signifies? Why did they want us to know it? Does this mean that these are allies, or one is a customer and one is a client? How do you hear that fact?
Well, they're not allies. I mean, you know, in Russia is not going to go to war with the United States if the U.S. attacks Iran. And Iran is not going to send troops to fight for Russia in Ukraine. So they're not allies in the sense that, you know, members of NATO are allies. But Iran has become a very important supplier of drones to Russia. I am quite sure that, as well as money, Iran is getting, you know, military technology in return. I would be very surprised if the conversation didn't include requests and probably promises in return, in particular of anti-aircraft missiles, which, of course, Iran would want to use to shoot down any incoming Israeli or American planes. There is now a considerable degree of military cooperation between the two. But, I mean, you know, what exactly did we expect? I mean, America had a chance at, you know, reconciliation, some form of detente with Iran, and it blew it years ago, to a degree mainly under Bush and then again under Trump, of course. We had a chance at, you know, trying to prevent conflict with Russia. We blew that as well. We just have to pray that we don't blow the chance to avoid conflict with China, because then, of course, we would really be in an interesting world.
To your remark, your essay in Harper's with George Beebe, your colleague at Quincy Institute, you write the only viable terms for such a compromise with Ukraine and the United States and Russia and its colleagues is for Russia to abandon its hopes of conquering more Ukrainian territory and reducing the whole of Ukraine to a client state. If I understand that correctly, because we've touched on this before, the Russian maximalist position is Novorossiya, and what would be left, which is the west of Kyiv and west of it to Lvov, one time Lemberg, but the Black Sea coast would be under Russian control, and I don't know whether Kharkiv would be part of it, but certainly Donetsk, Luhansk Oblast, Zaporizhia Oblast, Kherson Oblast, and Odessa Oblast. Is that, and Crimea, is that the position that Russia seeks to end this conflict?
Well, that was the maximalist position. I mean, there have been two maximalist Russian positions. When Russia invaded at the start of the war, it was clearly Putin's goal to turn the whole of Ukraine back into a Russian client state. Now, that was defeated, and I am told by Russian experts that it is now realized in the Kremlin that that just cannot happen, above all because, clearly, I mean, the overwhelming majority of Ukrainians are against it, and it, you know, the Russians genuinely expected, or at least the Kremlin did, that most Ukrainians would simply acquiesce in the Russian invasion, and many would welcome it. Well, of course, that didn't happen. So the maximalist goal has gone. That, by the way, was abandoned, I think, very early on. If you look at the terms of the, you know, the proposed peace settlement already in March of 2022. And replaced by neutrality. As to territory, that depends entirely on what happens on the battlefield, or, of course, whether there is a viable proposal from the West of a compromise peace. Russia is not going to get any more territory that it does not conquer. And it's very unclear how much more territory it can conquer. Obviously, Russia is doing better on the battlefield, but, you know, let's not forget that the Russian victories in recent months have been a few square miles and one small town. But on the other hand, Ukraine is not going to get back any of its territory that it cannot reconquer on the battlefield. Possibly some kind of neutral zone as part of a peace settlement. So either there is a compromised peace, which at the moment the West and Ukraine are ruling out, or the war goes on, and we just have to see, as I say, what happens on the battlefield.
A detail about the war going on. The Russian economy, surprising to many, has switched itself to wartime economy. Everything for the front, we're told. And as you and George Beebe report, it's outcompeting the ability of NATO and the United States and others to supply enough ammunition for the front. The Russians are, at this point, endeavoring, I guess you call it a war of attrition, and your measure is that the Russians can win a war of attrition. Now, here's the part that I want to understand. Winning the war means that the Russian people see this as a moment to return to normal, to declare victory and go back to the way they were before. Is that how the Russian people are hearing this? Not unhappy, but just let's get it over with.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, as far as I can make out, I mean, the mood in the Russian people, which Putin has cultivated, but also, exploited and responded to, is that we must not be defeated. That what the West and Ukraine are calling for is complete Russian defeat. Ukraine wants to hold this peace conference in Switzerland shortly, but the terms that Ukraine is proposing is complete Russian withdrawal from all the occupied territories, including Crimea, war crimes trials for Putin and his government, and Russian reparations. Well, that's not going to happen unless Ukraine can completely defeat the Russian army. I mean, impose a complete military victory. And that just doesn't look possible. I mean, if the US Congress does eventually vote through this package of arms and aid, I think that it is possible for the Ukrainians to hold the Russians, to defend Ukraine's existing positions more or less, maybe with small losses, because, as we've often discussed, present military technology very much favors the defensive. But that cuts both ways. If it's difficult for Russia to attack successfully, even given Russia's superiority in numbers and in ammunition, well, it's going to be even more difficult for Ukraine to attack successfully. So my suspicion is, and this is what George and I, reflected in our article, that at best what the West is looking forward to, and Ukraine is looking forward to, is a military stalemate along roughly present lines. But there is also a very real possibility, given the imbalance in numbers and in ammunition, that the Ukrainian front will in fact collapse, and there will be a Russian breakthrough. As I believe I've said previously on this program, everyone talks about the First World War on the Western Front as, a long war of attrition and stalemate. But of course, it did eventually break because, first almost the West and then eventually Germany, we're just so ground down by the other side that their armies collapsed.
Yes.
And at the moment, if either side is, that's going to happen to either side, it seems absolutely clear that it will happen to the Ukrainians and not the Russians.
I'm speaking with Anatole Leva of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. We're going to turn to considering NATO, which is looking beyond the Ukraine conflict, however it is resolved. I'm John Batchelor.